I think it's very interesting to open, as you said, a debate and a talk about this impact of the culture, this epoch in the subjectivity, and never losing, as you said, the internal work within psychoanalysis, within our consulting room, and also working within the social. So when I quote Lacanian way of saying declination of the father's name, I am talking about these times, this epoch, in which the reference, as I said, and the subjectivity fails in respecting what we can call the authority. But the authority means not authoritarian systems. It's the law, is the possibility of symbolization, and it's the way of being free too. Because without some limits, you cannot be creative, you cannot open to symbolization. So in a way, we are talking about how the other is working in this new social environment and how this evanescence of the father's name is part of a situation that leaves open to the death drive.
Welcome to the IPA podcast, Psychoanalysis on and off the couch. This podcast consists of conversations with psychoanalysts from around the world who share with us their clinical and psychoanalytic work with individuals both on and off the couch. And what we mean by off the couch is that they share with us their community involvement in many different venues apart from their consultation rooms. They describe their work in hospitals, in community clinics, in refugee centers, in classrooms, indeed in war zones. We also have conversations with psychoanalysts who are focusing their work on the couch, and they are continuing to refine both our familiar and novel understandings of the dynamic mind as it presents itself in the analytic situation. We've been talking to elders in our field, people who've been practicing for 50 plus years, and they share with us how they view this field evolving and where they see it going. We also talk to clinicians who had professions prior to becoming psychoanalysts, and they share with us their journeys to doing what they now love. These are just samplings of the psychoanalysts we've been talking with, again, from all corners of the globe. Please visit our website, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can subscribe, where you can see the recommended readings provided by our guests, and you can also leave a comment. I hope you enjoy these conversations and find them thoughtful and meaningful, and I appreciate your listening. Thank you. Welcome to today's podcast. I'm Harvey Schwartz, and my guest today is Dr. Gabriella Goldstein. Dr. Goldstein is a training and supervising analyst at the Argentina Psychoanalytic Association, APA, and the International Psychoanalytic Association, and she's also the past president of APA. Our conversation today revolves around a presentation she's made, and it's titled Psychoanalysis in Chaotic Times. Chaotic times is something that is often spoken by many. We are facing a troubled world in multiple dimensions. And Gabriella takes this concern, this attention, this need for study, and she includes in it our internal lives. And she brings us on a journey of how, yes, there is this chaos in the outside world, and there is also chaos in the inside world. And these patients come to our offices and share and live out the only internal world they know, which is a chaotic world, which exposes the analyst to chaotic experiences. And she helps us understand how she understands this and how she engages it. And there's one way to summarize what she does. She calls an analytic cure is such that love and not revenge for pain predominate. Love and not revenge for pain predominate. And that's just a taste of the pieces of wisdom that we have the opportunity to learn from not only listening to her, but reading her work. She has written widely. She is not only a psychoanalyst, she's also a practicing painter. She's also trained as an architect. She tells us a bit about this towards the end when we discuss her personal history. Her books are listed in the show notes, and she's won multiple awards. She's won the Mom Barringer Prize for Best Monograph in Psychoanalysis with her paper, The Aesthetics of Memory, Freud at the Acropolis. And she won the A. Storni Prize for Conceptual Contributions in Psychoanalysis with Transience or the Time of Beauty. She has served on multiple IPA and APA committees. It is a pleasure. I found it a great pleasure to get to know her and her writing. And there's something valuable in this for all of us, not only who practice psychoanalysis, but those who are struggling to be human in this world. So here is my conversation with Gabriella Goldstein. Gabriella, welcome to the podcast. It's so nice to have you here. Gabriella, we often nowadays around the world speak of chaos. It seems that the world is immersed in chaos. And what we generally refer to are the wars that are happening, the radical political polarization that's going on, the explosion of anti-Semitism as if it was a century ago. Climate collapse is ever present for all of us to see. This is the world we are struggling with. And what I so appreciate about reading your work is that while you acknowledge and honor these trying conditions we're all living under, you never lose sight of the internal. You're always aware of, well, there's the chaos outside, true enough, but there's also a state of chaos inside. And what can we as psychoanalysts bring in the face of that? And we're going to study together a paper you've written called Psychoanalysis in Chaotic Times, The Void and the Other. And we're going to walk through this paper, which begins with external chaos and then internal chaos. And we end, not so surprising, at the issue of love. And along the way, we touch on many, many themes that will transform chaos into love. And we talk about the presence and absence of the other. We talk about the psychoanalytic method. And we talk about something very dear to your heart, which is art, which is something you've devoted many, many years of your life to, which we will discuss as well. So I want to start us off by reading from the first paragraph of your paper. And it's about chaos. And you write, chaos is the personification of primordial emptiness prior to creation, which on the other hand is related to complexity, open systems and new links between disciplines. Art, culture, and science are related, creating, beyond the chaos, a new reality. This epoch, called the Anthropocene, exposes a dimension of the death drive that is evident as a tendency to the destruction of the world with wars, the climate, and planetary crisis, and in the social sphere. The fall of ties in the face of the evanescence of the Father's name. The chaos of the world tends to pierce subjectivity and affect the depths of the human being, but there is a possibility that the void will be transformed. And one of the places, perhaps one of the most appropriate for this potential transformation, is art. And a transformative device par excellence is psychoanalysis. This allows us to think about the unconscious in a creative way when working in a clinic at the service of Eros, which never dismisses the death drive. Gabriella, you want to help us out with this?
Well, I'm very happy to talk with you, Harvey. Thank you for this invitation. And I think it's very interesting to open, as you said, a debate and a talk about this impact of the culture, this epoch in the subjectivity, and never losing, as you said, the internal work within psychoanalysis, within our consulting room, and also working within the social. So when I quote Lacanian way of saying the declination of the father's name, I am talking about these times, this epoch, in which the reference, as I said, and the subjectivity fails in respecting what we can call the authority. But the authority means not authoritarian systems. Is the law, is the possibility of symbolization, and it's the way of being free too, because without some limits you cannot be creative, you cannot open to symbolization. So in a way we are talking about how the other is working in this new social environment, and how this evanescence of the father's name is part of a situation that leaves open to the death drive. It is important, this idea of the void, because the void can lead to creativity. The void can lead to desire, but we have to do many things to make it work.
An important point that I understand you to be making, the evanescence of the father's name, oftentimes people will take that idea and do two things with it, one of which is they will link it too literally to the presence of a father, as opposed to recognizing it as the father's name, that it's a function, that it's, said differently, it's the capacity of the mother of the child to maintain triangularity in her mind and to maintain a libidinal attachment to her own father, which creates a space for her children to embrace symbolization. The other point is that, speaking of politics, the father's name is often abused and turned into a cartoon. As you say, it dismisses authority and collapses it into a cartoonish authoritarianism, which is not what you mean by the father's name. The father's name is a caring, attentive sort, not an authoritarian sort. But I don't want to speak for you for that. Maybe you can clarify what you mean.
Yes, it is, as you have been saying, the idea of the other in the mind of the caretakers, whether it's a mother, an uncle, a grandmother, it's a function. Mm-hmm. It's a function that installs a third, the other, and the possibility of symbolization in the dyadic situation in the primal times. But this is also related to our contemporary civilization, to our contemporary world, in which some flattened or superficial way of living and understanding things because of many things, fragmentation, vulnerability, isolation, fragility of the links, and many things, may appear as a weakening of this function that makes the possibility of the other, which means not to function in a dyadic situation, which means dyadic may mean it's me or the other, and no relation in between, no construction between the two. That is the third place, the transitional place. And this is also what we can see in a macro situation in the world, which is the many figures, as you said, cartoonish, are appearing in the world scene as the father of the horde, the primal father, which has the It is complete. It's completely authoritarian. And it's not what we are talking about, limits.
An important distinction. Speaking about past times, you quote in the paper from Shakespeare's Hamlet, written in 1600. And the phrase is, the time is out of joint. The time is out of joint. Tell us why you find that important and what it tells us, actually, that Shakespeare was concerned about these issues, oh, these many hundreds of years ago.
Yes, this is may also link my way of seeing things and encountering things related also to art. So, on the one hand, this time is out of joint has shocked me when I was in Italy. It was an installation I saw in the Galleria Nazionale, written on the stairs of the gallery with lions all over. And I said, what is this? This is related to something. And this was before the pandemic. So it was a kind of something oracular that was coming. And I said, what does this mean? The time is out of joint. And in this research, I understood and I learned that I was not the only one who has paid attention to this magnificent Hamlet phrase in a terrible moment when he realizes that the time needed for mourning was out of joint and that incest was consumed and that the generational pact has been broken. So on the one hand, it shows us that what we've been saying about the father's name, which means that the reference do not exist now and that this generational pact has broken, means that the question of the incest, that means that the other is not in the mind of the caretaker or in the others, which means a limit, of course.
Right.
This is one thing that is universal and has been said very clearly by Hamlet. And of course, he's also talking about a world that was changing because monarchy was declining at that time. So the world was changing, and it's always changing. But the main thing is that, in a way, I felt that it was and it is what Freud says, that the poets are in advance to what happens in civilization and in our understanding. So this way of understanding and saying the world is out of joint because the world is going badly, because the world, as we said before, the social bonds are complicated, are fractured, out of joint, literally. And yes, and this leaves open a kind of perverse jouissance that appears in Hamlet times and nowadays. So I think it was a clear impact that even if it was said 600 years ago, it's very clearly impacting our thought nowadays.
Let me draw you to the clinical situation. We're inching our way there. You've set the stage for us to appreciate both the external and now increasingly internal chaos and void. And that, of course, brings us to the presence of the other in the mind of the individual. And you write the following. What place does the other occupy in primordial time? With the so-called borderline cases, which you prefer to call borderline states, we understand a social malaise that manifests itself in the loss of points of reference, characteristics of the contemporary social bond, and of the early alterations of the encounter with the other. There is no life without the other. And then you go on to say, today we understand that beyond the word and the sayable, this dimension is acted out in other scenes and scenarios, on the verge of transference or outside of it. Thus, the possibility of an expanded listening is put into play in an expanded analytic field
to generate the possibility of being heard today where there was no response from the other. Again, there's so much in what you write. Let me just pick on one piece of it. You talk about expanded listening in an expanded analytical field to generate the possibility of being heard. Tell us what you mean.
Well, given my the place where I work and my what is so-called the Argentinian school, I quote in a way what Béranger said about the analytic field that was taken by other contemporary analysts. An expanded analytic field may refer for me to what was thought that was outside from transference and outside from the analytic field may be heard now as part of an expanded analytic field. So to say, for instance, the acts, what of course we understand as acting out, but how do we think about this acting out or this psychosomatic events or some panic attacks or some other direct questions that in which the conflict is outside from the possibility of being thinkable. There is no conflict, but a direct situation with the body or with the action. And I think that now we can consider all these ways of expression, we could say, another way, other ways of expression of what happens to the subject that eludes the conflict, but shows something that is happening within his psyche, within his soul, we could say, within his passions that are yet not linked in a way to be able to be shown as a symptom, for instance, or as a lapsus, or as the things that we are used or we know how for a long time how to listen as the productions of the unconscious. So this is what I mean, that it is important to include them into the way of listening. And also I am talking about what we all know, which is all the things that happen in a session, all the things that happen, the way a patient enters, the way he moves, the tune of his voice, the way he touches his hair, many things that can talk if they cannot talk, that they can say things that cannot be yet said or expressed.
And you're inviting the clinician to not see these actions or somatizations as simply deviations from the use of words and symbolizations, but as my words would be to say it as the patient is expressing themselves in the best way they know how at this particular moment.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And it's our job to try to understand why this is the best way they know how at this time and invite them to be curious about it. The temptation, going back to the cartoon authoritarianism, is, and this is a hard thing in teaching students of analysis, that the temptation, and it's we all feel it, it's not just the students, the temptation at times is to assume that authoritarian position because we feel pulled into wanting the patient to stop doing that. And our job, of course, is to note that we when we are being drawn into that, and ideally not to act on it, at least not too often, and to maintain our analytic position, which is, let's understand this. And I think you make the point very well about how this needs to be included. In fact, you go on to write, psychoanalysis today needs to think with the fundamental elements that are enriched or deconstructed, that are not closed to the struggle, the other, the diverse, and to multiple approaches, but that require us to think of an expanded field. And you list the intrapsychic, intersubjective, intrasubjective, the third, the reality field, that in our practice implies giving relevance to the open form. Now, tell us more about open form.
I like very much the way that you said interrogating and asking us. The two of us means the patient is constructing something with the analyst, and there is a intermediate area, of course, a transitional area in which something is constructed in between and can be interrogated to bring it not as a superego but as an interrogation. So I like it very much the way you understood and put the what I have thought and share with us. And when I use this idea of open form, I use it in a very in a way to express many things. One of them, of course, is the idea I brought in the first paragraph, which is open systems related to chaos and the possibility of have this multiple approach to be helpful to our patients nowadays, which means to honor Freud's idea of multi-determination, which is that things that happen in a subject, in a person, and in life are multi-determined and are open to different things that make influence, as I said, in this intrapsychic, intersubjective, tertiary, and reality field, because we are all the time influenced and constructed also by reality. So it is related to the concept, to the complexity paradigm, on another hand. And of course, it is related to an idea that I like very much, which is the open mind, which is also related to what I said with the expanded field and expanded listening. Open mind, it's an idea that was shared by an Argentinian colleague, Badaracco, and of course about Christopher Bolas. He talks about the open mind. And I think it's also an idea that relates to respect the way of being of someone and to try to help him in what is not possible for him, for the analyst, what is being something that makes him suffer, the sufferance, the pain, within his way of being, not to try to change that completely. And also I'm referring to interpretation. I think that interpretation is something that we are managing nowadays with these kind of presentations in a very open way, which means maybe to use some some questions, to open questions, to invite someone to keep on talking, and to use some ways of saying and listening, like what if or the conditional, and never to make a close interpretation. It was maybe thought in sometimes that this means exactly this, because what we try is not to make something that is close and that has just one meaning. And conscious has multivocity as a principle of his richness, this richness. So these are the ideas that I have opened from the idea of the open form. And even one more, last but not least, I want to quote something from my artist experience. When I was painting, when I am painting, and when I was learning to paint, I had a teacher, a professor, and he said, your painting has to breathe. It has to be open. The work has to breathe to be open. And it may be something that sounds a little metaphorical, but also the mind has to breathe. And this is what we are working in psychoanalysis.
Well, just as you point out, the patient's somatic expression of their inner life So too is that the case for the analyst. We are in different states of tension, including breathing, when we are with either different patients or the same patients at different times. So there is a parallel, a somatizing parallel that goes on in the office if there's an aliveness mm-hmm. between the two of them. But I don't want to lose, speaking of metaphor, you in that same paragraph that I just read, you write about the halo of metaphors that surround mm-hmm. meanings of words. Now, mm-hmm. I think I know what you mean, but it's so beautifully said. why don't you flesh out what you mean by it?
Well, it's moving to the very early states of mind when the newborn, the infants, is related to the other. This experiential moment in which the other, we could say the mother, to make it more simple, opens the meanings and brings the possibility of the infants to express and not to close again the significant, the meaning, what signifies what he is trying to express with the beyond the words, of course, beyond the language and the articulated word, which means also to it is related to if there is a psychotic mother, for instance, she would say this is this, but then again this halo is all the bath of words and metaphors that could be not spoken but felt like experience. In English, we don't have two words for experience. In Spanish, we have the word vivencia and experiencia. And for the first moments of the first pleasure experience, we say primer vivencia de satisfacción, which is something even more strong in the body and related to the this like an aura, in a good sense, mm-hmm. of things that have not yet made a meaning, but are on their way to have different meanings.
Oh, that's wonderful. I hadn't known that language difference. Well, let me pick up on that, on the way to having different meanings, because the next section of your paper is called Unconscious and Art. And I want to read a quote that you bring forward from Freud. It's a little challenging to grasp. I will read it particularly slowly, and then I will ask you about it. He writes, "The unconscious is the psychic that is truly real. It is as unknown to us in its inner nature as the real of the external world. And it is given to us by the data of consciousness as incompletely as the external world is given by the indication of our sense organs." And then you write, "However, this knowledge is possible through its connection with words, the only access to consciousness, and constituted from the relationship with language. But," and this is your point, "but there is always something else which overflows, a surplus, which is part of the aesthetic experience, as in transference in the analytic session." Want to help us with that?
Yes. Of course, it's important to know that this quote in Freud, a very early quote in Freud, gives us the key to understand that even though we use the word because it's our mean, the word, the way we are able to work, to the way we are able to make contact and to express, and is the only way to consciousness. As Freud says, nothing is completely objective. There are always things that are not understandable, that are kept by our sense organs, which is feelings, sensations, and what we feel, because this is where the point which I want to outline regarding the aesthetic experience. the sensation and the feelings are difficult to translate into words. And this happens also in transference. There are things that are beyond the word and that are felt and that are included in what I say as an expanded field of transference. And we work with that. We could call it, of course, counter-transference, but my idea is that it overflows everything that can be understood as transference and counter-transference. Some things that remain unknown, that are felt, that are part of a shared experience in the analytic situation, and in life, of course.
Let me nudge you a little bit on this. We're talking about an expanded field. What does that look like clinically? You're describing, if I understand it right, something beyond a patient lying down, sitting up, and you're sitting in your chair and taking in all that's going on, both the nonverbal and the verbal. Is there more that's going on? Is there, putting aside the issue of touching, is there more expression? Is there music? Is there dance? Are there gifts? What is it that, how is this expressed, this open field, for those who don't have words meaning what other people have words meaning?
I think it is related to the way we are able to be, we could say, on the opposite of what was said for a long time, that you have to remain silent and listening. Sometimes you have to be more active and to share or to expose. Sometimes you said, well, what now? It makes me think, you can say as an analyst, or this brings me an idea of what maybe you are saying this or that. And so it refers not to something that is material, but to something that is related to a more open way, an active way of including, we could say, the drive or the libidinal situation into the session. It doesn't mean that you have to touch the patient, but it means that you touch him with the words and with the meaning of the words. And the words and what you say is not what you say. It is the way that you say it. And in the way you say it, you can be warm, you can be inviting, you can share, and even you can share other things, like you can say, well, did you see that film? Or would you like to, or what you were saying, or not saying, of course, reminds me of a book. Maybe he wouldn't take it, but maybe he will. But it's a way of constructing and offering ideas, representations, where, when there is a difficult situation, of being able to talk about them. And with, of course, we could say with the expectation or the idea that it might happen. We are always knowing that it may happen, that something appears.
Mm-hmm. It would be too simplifying to categorize what you just said as in the world of self-revelation. But let's be simple for a moment. What is your sense of how that can perhaps be useful at times?
I think it is very interesting how some patients relate to more concrete ideas, like I see they bring, for instance, something that happened in his everyday life. And we can think, well, this is the manifest content and he's not bringing anything. Or maybe it's a way of resistance and he brings, but maybe you can bring something that is related to his idea, another, like a dialogue between two books or two films, knowing that, I think the difference is that it's not a dialogue between two friends.
Yes.
It is that you know as an analyst that in a way that is not yet possible to say or to understand, you are talking about unconscious and about his subjective life.
I think that's beautifully said. There is a school of psychoanalysis here in the States, and they call that joining the resistance. And it's an interesting phrase. It's an interesting idea, one perhaps for another time. But I think many people who are clinicians who will be listening to this will nod their head in acknowledgement of how this can be useful and how maybe sometimes they're uncomfortable speaking about it for a whole other set of reasons. Let me return to your paper, and it really segues beautifully. This is into the section of the non-response of the other, speaking of which. You write, "We are investigating the current clinic and the unconscious when trauma is understood as an effect of what is beyond articulated language. We constitute ourselves in the field of the other with the sounds of their discourse, with inaudible transgenerational traces. Social pain also derives from the discontinuity, sometimes transitory, of the reinvestment of the sufferings of everyday life. This is linked to the failure of the other in the founding time of the defenseless offspring. Conceptually, it can be reinvested with the trust in the other. This opens the question about the obstacles to addressing dimensions of psyche different from the repressed, early childhood experiences for which most of the time it is impossible to awaken a memory. How to weave the bonds with what was never thought of." How to weave the bonds with what was never thought of. I think that's what you were just describing doing when you're comparing books and movies, yes?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, yes. Yes. I think it's what we are in. It's an important moment because we are receiving in our consulting rooms patients that in other times were considered not for analysis or inanalysable, as we say in Spanish, or on the limits of the analysis.
Right.
And now we know that we can work, as we've been talking, bringing. Offering images, ideas, and in a dialectical situation always, not including something that is not in the field. This is what I mean by the expanded field. Something that arises in the field is picked up and maybe related or talk or speak by the analyst. And this is how we try to awaken things, maybe pieces, fragments of memory or hypothetical constructions, as we know very well in constructions in psychoanalysis, to begin to weave this that was never thought. Mm. And things that were in the beyond what we call classically symptoms, which means the expressions of the unconscious, can be included maybe because we keep up with the, as you said, with the hope, with the expectation that some patient could be in some moment able to think more or to talk about himself if he doesn't. So it's this is the way that we can open these obstacles and the dimension in which the acts, addictions, somatizations and different kinds of manifestations that are not strictly unconscious formations as we know how to work with them. So it's a real challenge, and it's an expanded way of helping what could be a symptom of the time, which is the helplessness, the vulnerability, the feeling of fragmentation, and also some possibility of flattening the interior and the intimacy because of the way the links and the bonds in our society are established. So on the one hand, as you see, I talk about the primal times in which a psyche is arising and where it could happen that the other was not there in the minimum needed time to include the possibility of desiring, and that the place of the lack of the other turns into a void, which is quite different. So this void needs to be not covered, but weaved, we could say, on the borders with words and with the meaning and with the feeling, because words have also a sensitive question within them. It's not just the meaning.
We know that different analysts have different abilities to work with different kinds of patients, stating the obvious. And some analysts have a talent to work in this halo state that you're describing. And in something else you've written, a sentence you wrote jumped out at me that I'd like to read. And you wrote, "My personal experience as a painter predisposes me to listening in clinical practice to what we call actual pathologies, what emerges as an image on the edges of the speakable, also to the complex therapeutic paths in our practice in relation to what we commonly refer to as creativity." Can you tell us what you mean by that? I don't mean to be blunt in your question, but you're connecting for us your being a painter with your being open to these to the voids, to the halos, to the somatizations. Do I hear you right?
Yes. It's there are many things within this idea. One of the things I could maybe said in a very graphic way, so to say, would be as I am in front of a white canvas, so to say, and I don't know what will happen, because sometimes I don't know as a painter. And I kind of have a, I wouldn't say anxiety, but what is that? A kind of a, I don't know what will happen. So then I stay there. I stay there. And if I am able, I let my mind flow. We could say that free association. Mm-hmm. And there is a feeling, many psychoanalysts talk about regression in these states. I prefer to talk about dialectics in which you are able to inhabit a state that I call an area of estrangement, an area of aesthetic experience. And then you are able to reach also some nice feelings, some pleasurable feelings, but also some nostalgic ideas, or some ideas that come from some traumatic events. And all this is what appears in the work. I feel more open in these cases, as, for instance, a patient that was saying, lying on the couch so many times, I don't know, and silence. I don't know. Long silences for many, many sessions. And of course, I could have said it's a resistance. She doesn't want to speak. It's a resistance to the analysis, or it's my resistance, or what is going on. But then I thought, well, maybe I don't know is I can't see. I can see my unconscious. I don't know. I can't see means I can't understand. I don't know what is going in my mind. So then a dialogue began, and I thought that maybe she was in front of a white canvas in a metaphor, like not knowing what was happening, if she had something that she would not know in her unconscious, and how would she acknowledge the possibility of knowing what is going on in her unconscious. And then many associations came and I said, well, maybe you cannot see And she said, in fact, I have to see my eyes because I have myopia. And then many associations came because she had a myopia when she was since she's a child. And so she couldn't see her image when she couldn't think about her identity and being reflected in a clear way. So thinking about this area made me more open, not to think immediately as repression or resistances, or like being able to inhabit an area in which a repetition of something that could be frustrating for the analyst could become a previous moment of an opening, not closing, as I said, the idea of resistance.
That goes back to the understanding we spoke earlier, that she was being the best way she knew how to be under the internal pressures she was operating under. And you mm-hmm. were being painter-like, creative-like, analyst-like, attentive and imaginary, and imaginative in reverie to put pieces together that didn't seem to belong there, but it touched her and awakened her.
Mm-hmm.
Which brings us to the cure on chapter 7. That's a word you use, and I will read. Reuniting with the other is the reopening of the window of cure. The place of the other is that in that cure is that of love, of transference, and the possibility of loving. One of the keys to the cure in psychoanalysis is in the marks of early childhood. Psychoanalysis can cure that, but it has to confess that this wound can be sutured step by step so that love and not revenge for pain predominate. I'll read that again. So that love and not revenge for pain predominate. We can say that the analytic cure has to do with a healthy reversion to a possible dependence. Let us remember that Freud, with the principle of abstinence or neutrality, in no way excludes a deep proximity. But as you quote Recalcati, he said, a knowing how to remain at a distance defines the position of the analyst. Want to share with us that phrase so powerful, so that love and not revenge for pain predominate?
I am very interested in the state of mind in which revenge predominates. And I think it's a state of the world in which revenge predominates. So we have to think that something that could have happened that was good in the encounter with the other, in the loving situation, has not happened. And also that the natural mournings that have to be done in the separations, which separation is a key concept to understand the possibilities of symbolization, of mourning, of desiring, and of loving separation. But to be able to be separated from the other, from the breast, from the mother, from the feces, from everything, you have to have had a previous Winnicottian way of saying very well, good enough situation with the other. So the other had to be available, good enough, and in the time of the response. If that doesn't happen in very early times, if that doesn't happen, if love does not come from the other in the way it can come, good enough as a response, as a way of understanding the newborn also as someone different from my own narcissism as a mother. So this means that the mother or the other has the other in her head, the third. Then a dyadic situation can happen and can remain. And the mournings needed for the sequence of separations, of good separations in life, do not happen. And as we know very well, if there is no grieving, no mourning, there is paranoia. And if there is paranoia, in a wide way of saying, there is a wish of revenge. So the response of the other in nowadays clinics is very important, because the other is the other of the primal times, but also is the social other that doesn't leave us apart, that includes us. And revenge is something very painful. It's a response to the pain and to the vulnerability too of nowadays contemporary world, not only in the primary time. So I'm always kind of basculating or creating a dialectic between the primal times, the traumatic events that could happen, and what can happen in the social contemporary world that we are living, which in a way could be an expanded complementary series in Freud's thought.
You said it, Gabriella, almost as beautifully as you wrote it. And with that, let me read, and I do want to save time because I want to ask you to share with our listeners a bit of your own psychoanalytic journey. But I do want to read the last few sentences of this paper, which picks up on just what you were saying. You write, "Psychoanalysis never leaves the human soul unscathed because it reveals what the human being does not want to see. We have to give up the illusion of easy solutions, definitiveness. Analysts are the architects of the adventure that investigates the world today, vulnerable, its cruelty, and its unfathomable mysteries. It is also a wonderful world, because the seed of the life impulse of a malaise in culture always grows. Then there is love, difference, and otherness. It is the calculated risk of living the life drive and the bet on freedom." Bravo, really. That was a special few sentences. But we have some time. Tell us about you. You mentioned an architect in that last sentence. That's one of your many trainings and skills, an architect, but piece together a picture so that the listener can know who you are.
Of course, I'm a psychoanalyst. I have graduated. I have two degrees. My first degree is architecture and psychology, PhD, doctor. I think what is maybe interesting to share with you is that, in fact, I was brought up in a Buenos Aires in a very nice and interesting moment. The 60s in Buenos Aires was a moment of flourishing of psychoanalysis and culture. Psychoanalysis and culture were together. And I was born in a psychoanalytical media. So I had an atmosphere. I had the luck and also the experience, the very early experience of a child analysis, when the Kleinism was the dogma in Argentinian psychoanalysis. So I have many experiences in my flesh. One experience is the analytic, the child analysis on my own I had. And in that media, as I said, psychoanalysis was avant-garde and was related to the culture of avant-garde. So I have breathed all that atmosphere of the performances, the new of the contemporary moment in culture in Buenos Aires. That was like a very effervescent an event. And psychoanalysis was maybe because it's different than in other parts of the world, it was very open to everyone, and it is still. It's not just a discipline that is for people that is in a severe mental state. In Argentina, in Buenos Aires, but of course in Argentina, in that time, psychoanalysis was a way of knowing yourself. So being brought in that media, I had a very strong experience of what psychoanalysis can do for the subject, for the world. And this is maybe why I was always related to culture. And in that way, in that situation, of course, I had my child analysis, my own child analysis and adolescent analysis. And also I was, my parents took me to exhibitions and to classes of paintings. And so my aesthetic and my creativity drive, we could say, was awakened. So I had to decide in a moment whether I would study for becoming a doctor, which was my first idea, or my creative side, which means to paint. Of course, I'm a painter too, would be my first choice. So I decided first architecture, which would be like kind of a compromise between being a painter, which is still something I do in a professional way, and being a psychoanalyst. But then I have always been related to the psychoanalytic world, which was never apart from culture and from the way of thinking, an open way. For instance, I went to a very, when I was a child at 6 or 7, I went to classes of painting, and the teacher taught us to work with the surrealistic method, which I didn't know it was, which was to make a kind of a squiggle, which was for the surrealistics is called the automatism, which is a way of drawing something and finding something that comes from the unconscious. I didn't know that at that time, but it was very, I enjoyed a lot to bring figures out from all this squiggle that I didn't know it was a squiggle, and to bring things from within, to make appear figures, images, and representations from other part I didn't know, and that was formless. And that was from a very early moment in my life. Maybe I still paint in that way. I try to make things appear as the other, like what does the paint is suggesting me, where the other, which is also a work of art, suggest me to go to. And I think that this way of thinking in a dialectical way is still in me, in the way I work with patients.
I was just going to say, it sounds very similar to the open mind you described in what is the patient bringing to me, and being open to that with as little concrete literalness as possible, just opening the field, let's see what we discover.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yes. Yes. So this is a very summarized way of telling how this very rich, open area and a way of feeling included in the world and in the culture and making a dialogue, a dialectic situation between psychoanalysis, between what the patient brings, between theories, the writings, and the painting. What comes from the other? What comes from outside? And how do we begin a dialogue? And what the situation suggests me as a way of following a line of thought or of painting?
You bring us back to our beginning, which is starting from the outside and creating a dialogue that honors the other and brings us to love and through art and psychoanalysis. And I feel with reading and rereading much of your work, I feel that I've gone on that journey, and hopefully the listener will have a taste of it. Have a taste of your sense of your appreciation of the outside forces and how that leads you internally further and further to that open canvas that we face every day when we go into our office. Gabriele, thank you. thank you for being here. Thank you for really your gifted work. It's wonderful to immerse myself in it and to allow me and us to introduce it to listeners. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Harvey. For me, it's really a pleasure to join together this journey and to share and to establish a dialogue about how we can think about introducing the Eros dynamic in nowadays, which is very difficult with all what is happening in the world.
Yeah. To be continued. Thank you much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening. If I may, I'd like to ask you to help us publicize our podcast by rating us on iTunes or simply sharing it with a friend. You can also visit our webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can both subscribe and also add your comments. I'd also like to acknowledge the lovely rendition of Beethoven's Opus 18th String Quartet by the Allegri String Quartet on the Vivat label.